That doesn't happen too often around here, but we sure got him today. I hope the record reflects that. I won't go by name because I'll let the computer figure that out. Who's who? The first bill I would like to take up, I hope that you will bear with me, people that are here, for another bill. I do have some other ones I want to get out of the way real quick. It won't take very long, I don't think. The first bill I'd like to hear is committee substitute for Senate Bill 294. You'll open up your packets, you will find, and that is an act relating to the compensation of state officers and employees not covered by collective bargaining and providing for an effective date. You will find on your in your packets a House committee substitute for Senate Bill number 294, State Affairs. If you will please get that in front of you and look down on page 2. All right, the first thing I would like to do, I'm sorry, the first thing I would like to do is move and ask unanimous consent that we rescind our action on Senate Bill number 294 that we took the other day.
Mr. Chairman,
for the purposes of a committee substitute. Do I hear a motion to that effect?
I was going to make a motion on the other hand. I will move that we rescind our action of the other day for the purpose of a committee substitute.
Motion's been made. Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. We now have in front of us, there is a House committee substitute for Senate Bill 294 in front of us at this time. The changes are on page 2, line 16, and 23, the salary of the legislators. Now, for the people out in the audience, I'm going to depart just a moment. This little pin there, this little paper clip I've got here, is supposed to be diamonds and so on and so forth, but it isn't. You find a lot of people wearing nice buttons. This is my symbol of poverty for legislators. I would remind the committee that we are paid on the same salary basis as a messenger, a page, and a few more. And if we raise our salaries 5 steps, we then become in the same category as a Xerox operator and a lounge attendant. We are 1 step now below, with no reflection on the occupations or vocations, 1 step below a dormitory attendant. That seems very strange when the legislators are dealing in the kind of monies we have to and the concerns of the people and the concerns of the program of everyone in the state. And it seems no more than right and proper that this should be given some consideration. It also repeals the per diem at $80 a day, and it repeals that, so we will not be getting it, and the monies will come out of our own pockets to live down here. So that's one good thing that the people will like. The one other good thing that it does, or the bad thing for the people, evidently from what I gather, that it does raise our salaries to a range 22, step A. And that, I believe, is $46,800 a month. A year. I swear I saw a month in there. I would entertain a motion to accept the House Committee substitute for Senate Bill 294, State Affairs. Or is there any...
So moved.
It has been moved. Is there any debate?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Furness.
Just a couple of notes. For those of you who may... Some would question this. If you look at the overall compensation received by legislators, you'll find that that can go, I believe, as high as about $46,000-$47,000 a year. What this does is take the pressure off of extending out. You'll find a number of legislators are here on an extended basis, and they could indeed draw more monies in there. What this ultimately is going to do, hopefully, is serve to shorten the legislative session. We're right now, and I think this is the 130th day. We may, in essence, go probably another 10 to 15 days. What this does is put the burden upon the legislators, since there's no longer the receipt of the $80 a day additional remuneration for however long the session, it cuts that off. And it puts it a psalm certain that the legislators, in turn, will take this money and pay the hotel, take care of whatever else expenses. And the state is not subjected to this continuation of the the appropriations that have taken place, as I recall, we dealt with some $900,000 the other day. Should this legislature go past, I believe, the end of June, we would in turn be looking at an additional appropriation. Mr. Chairman, again, the basis I want to share here is that what this is going to do is set a sum certain and take away that the need for that supplemental appropriation because of the extended length of the session. I endorse the 120 days. I hope that we can get that passed in the Senate, ultimately signed by the governor this year, and that we can indeed put a limit. This is a good idea, a good way of perhaps encouraging that.
Thank you, Mr. Furness. Mr. Cowdery.
Yes, I would like to comment, too, that with the present pay scale that we have here, we've eliminated a certain group of people who probably were impacting the most with the legislation that we're enacting here, and that's that group of people, that scenario of a person who's married 10 years, got 3 kids, a house, and car payments and the normal expenses of a family, that he... I think is eliminated from becoming a legislator because he, if that is his only income, I don't think that he could go away from home and come down here and maintain his home and that family, the same style of living that he could or he's accustomed to with his other income, whether he was a laborer or for whatever he had accustomed to before. I know in my particular situation, I'm fortunate enough that I don't have to support or rely on my income here for my support, but there's other legislators that are less fortunate, and I think that by putting a reasonable salary to the legislators, and I would like to even say limit the legislators to 2 terms, if that be the case, so we could take a professional legislator out of office. But that's another amendment that possibly would be in order. But I think that by giving a fair wage, we'd open up the lawmaking process to more people that we're impacting the most, in that middle working class people, that the laws that we're making that's going to impact the most.
Thank you, Mr. Cotter. Mr. Miller?
Yeah, Mr. Speaker, I just wanted to turn. I think we're probably all on the same side, so I guess we really don't need to protract the debate, except I just want to point out that this is still well under a division director salary. Lest anybody think this elevates us to commissioner status or anything like that, it's well under even a division director, who I think is around range 26. This is range 22. So, I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in that category.
I would entertain a motion to move.
So moved.
It's been moved that we move out of committee, House Committee Substitute, Senate Bill Number 294, State Affairs. Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. The Senate Bill 132, which is the Alaska Administrative Journal. The bill was before the committee on Monday. We do have a committee substitute, and it was offered at that time 2 amendments, which we did accept. However, the maker of the amendment realized that he misunderstood some information contained in the amendment. We've corrected the amendments in the work draft. Has been prepared for the committee's review. If you'll take a look, please, at the work draft. And that is the committee substitute. Wait just a minute, I got a bundle up here. Yeah. It is the House Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 132 State Affairs, and is one that's written in pen, House, right above by State Affairs Committee. And we have that in front of us. Okay, the changes are page 1, line 26 and 28. After 8 on 26, reference to state computer, to the state computer database that includes a summary of the text of formal opinions and memoranda of advice of the Attorney General. It's the base that we were talking about, that it does have it in the computer, that they can get it out if they want. Also on page 2, line 28, the repeal date has been changed to July 1, 1985. That's on page 2, line 28. July 1, 1985. And on page 2, line 29, the effective date has been changed to July 1, 1983. I would, the first thing I've got to do is rescind our action on accepting the other two amendments that were based on erroneous information.
Chairman.
So I would ask and move unanimous consent that we rescind our action on adopting the amendments to the committee substitute for Senate Bill 132 as we adopted in the last meeting on Monday. Do I hear any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. We now have in before us a House committee substitute for committee substitute for Senate Bill 132 State Affairs with the amendments placed in the proper areas. Are there any, is there any debate on the bill? Hearing none, I'm ready for a motion.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Furness.
I would so move passage of House Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for Senate Bill Number 132 State Affairs from the Committee to the next Committee Referral. Pass by unanimous consent.
Do I hear any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman. Just a point of clarification. We adopted the Committee Substitute.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Very good.
Okay, we have, I think Mr. Vasca, I imagine our views will be the same, our signatures will be the same on the bill that we did sign. Do you have any objections to that? You have no right.
Yep.
Is that right? Mr. Vasca, you have to sign that. Okay, who stole my? The next bill I wish to take up is Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 215, an act authorizing the use of the last permanent fund income to pay longevity bonuses. And I hear a big sigh out there saying, at last. Is that right? No.
What?
Big sigh. At last.
Yeah.
Okay, I have, what about this? Is that signature for you to put it in there? Okay. The one we're going to use has the word latest on it. Committee Substitute, Senate Bill Number 215, Second Rules. Any objection to that? We all have what we're looking at. Yeah, it says latest on it. I see on the testimony sheet, I see Rose Palmquist. Hey, Rose, would you care to come up and give some testimony?
I was going to wait until some understand that the aide to Joe Hayes is going to testify.
Okay, Rose, I'll be
sure. I'd like to wait until afterwards.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The original sponsors are, is there anyone here to testify on the bill other than we've heard thus far? Mr. Munson, Phelps, Neil, are you here to testify?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, while Neil's coming forward, could I ask a quick question? Did you say that the draft we're dealing with says later or last?
Well, mine says latest. I don't know what yours says.
I just got a later. Maybe
it's
late. Oh, okay. Okay.
Mine's we've got our first, second, third, fourth.
517-83.
And it's dated 517-83?
Got the thing.
And latest. We've got one in here that says too late also. Do we want to use that? No, we don't want to use that. Mr. Phelps Munson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am Neil Phelps Munson, aide to House Speaker Joe Hayes, who opposes the Senate Bill 215 for a variety of reasons. Principal among them is that it does not adequately address the reasons for which the bill is at issue in the first place. If indeed the bill could be construed to meet the original intentions of the program, it certainly does not satisfy the requirements of the court suit that brought it before you today, because it doesn't deal with the retroactive requirements of the overall situation. That alone should disqualify the bill from passage. However, that obviously could be remedied in other ways. It's obviously not in this bill. The original intention of the longevity bonus program was to make it possible for all segments of the Alaskan population to participate in the new and growing wealth of the state. Those who were in the economic mainstream at the time, it was thought, would be participating right along through better transportation systems, improved public institutions of various kinds, and enhanced job opportunities in the market. People who were at or near or beyond retirement age, who were not in the economic mainstream of the state, would not receive the benefits to the extent that others would, who would yet be spending their productive years here. And so the longevity bonus program was established to allow the people who had been here, who had helped to build the state to what it's become, what it had become 10 years ago, in the new wealth of the state. Very deliberately, in the original design of the program, there was an unstated but automatic termination. That is, on January 3 of next year, no new recipients to the program would have become eligible. And so, as the last of the old pioneers left us, the program would automatically have terminated. The present bill, then, obviously, is grounded in an entirely different philosophy, so that it's not responsive just to the continuation of the longevity bonus program, which was challenged in the courts. It's an entirely new, separate, and different program based on totally different criteria. It really has nothing to do with the name it's carrying, that is, longevity bonus program, which was the original program devised about a dozen years ago. The bill, as the committee is perhaps not aware, has had no public hearings to date, and yet is potentially within a committee of final passage. A bill of this impact, it seems to me, merits a rather extensive public hearing, airing outside committee rooms. There have been, I'm told, no teleconferences on the legislation to date. The bill constitutes, obviously, the first incursion into the earnings of the permanent fund, which would be directed to the benefit of a single group. It is argued that eventually everyone will participate in that group. Of course, that's not true. Some of us won't live long enough to qualify, and many of us will not stay in Alaska long enough to qualify. And yet, a portion of what we are told is our collective common wealth would be used under this program on an expanding basis to serve the interests of one particular group of the population. That is not in violation of any law, but certainly of the intent and principles of the permanent fund and its dividend earning program. The program, some hold, I think rightly, is potentially wasteful of that particular resource, because many people stay in Alaska to retire because they can. Some come to Alaska to retire because they can and don't have the need at which this program is aimed, in spite of the fact that it's not called a need-based program. It certainly has that function, and it would divert an economic resource to some extent toward people who don't have need of it. The only universally permissible criterion for such programs is not even addressed, and that is one of need. Of all the various giveaway, assistance, handout, welfare, etc. programs that the state is presently operating, nearly all of them are under challenge of one sort or another, except those based solely upon need, and those seem to have no problem either here or in other states. There is a substantial body of legal opinion which holds that the original legislation would be upheld in a higher court. It is the feeling of a number of the opponents of this bill that an alternative program of some kind should not, particularly of these dimensions, should not be addressed, should not be instituted, should not even be seriously considered, except in a preliminary sense perhaps, until the final word is heard from the courts on the extant case. The agreement reached by the Legislative Council with the court was that, excuse me, the legislature would make every good and true effort, diligent effort, to come up with an acceptable solution. Obviously, the legislature has not done that. There perhaps is no acceptable alternative solution. This certainly is not it, although the legislature certainly has tried, and the Senate committee working on the legislation spent many long hours trying to reach that goal. It is the Speaker's opinion, and others who opposed the bill, they did not reach that goal, that perhaps it is unreachable. Perhaps the issue should remain in the courts until we hear the last word there.
Questions from the committee? Mr. Miller.
Yeah, I was curious about this substantial body of opinion that thinks we can win this case. I've yet to hear one lawyer that thinks we even got a chance. What is
I am told that the administration has a legal opinion that it's perfectly willing to go to court on. And I don't have names to say, I'm sorry.
I appreciate having those names, because I've heard from the administration just exactly the opposite.
Mr. Cowdery.
Yes. In the original, like the intent of it was, the original program for the longevity bonus was to honor Alaskans who had been here since statehood or based on the early timer. And then this program, as I understand it, or this bill, is changed around to establish a retirement benefit to people that now may, in the past, or at the present, or in the near future, or in the future, would become residents by the 1 year resident, if that's my information is right. It seems to be two different issues. Is that?
Yes, sir. That's my interpretation of it, Mr. Chairman.
That's awesome.
That this is not aimed at maintaining the original program, but just shifting it around enough to make it legal. It's a totally separate and different program. It is not the Pioneers or the Alaskan Longevity Bonus Program at all. It's something completely new.
I would, for the benefit of the audience and the committee again, I'll reiterate one more time that we did have in front of us a bill generated by the State Affairs Committee that was the residency bill. We purposely did not address the longevity bonus program because of its complexities when you deal with the monies involved in it, number one. And that's one reason. The other reason, the first reason, was that it was under litigation. And we didn't feel comfortable in addressing that particular facet of the longevity or the residency while this was under litigation. We did find out, however, during the course of events, that the 25 years of longevity bonus requirements was unconstitutional. Yet, on the same token, we did have reason to believe, and we did have opinions from law stating that it could be defensible. There was an argument that it could be made defensible in the case because of the age of the people involved and the length of time they've been in the one particular area. Now, what validity that has at this point in time, that's up to the courts. And right now, we're assuming that the state will win. And on the other hand, we're assuming, on the other hand, that they will not win. So again, it's still in the air. This does not address the problem in this particular case. That will allow anybody over 65 years old, 65 or over, for a longevity bonus if they've been in the state a year, because that is constitutional. Therein lies the problem. So now the fiscal notes are, in some cases, horrendous. From this point on, can the state in fact afford to do it? Now we've got to take a lot of the emotion out of it, which is very, very difficult to do. This is not a welfare program we're working on. It certainly isn't. And I wouldn't like to have anybody think that it would be a welfare, because that is definitely not the case. We don't look at it. Secondly, and more importantly, one of the biggest fears, as we heard on the floor this morning, gentlemen, that if we use the state or people have the right to take out of the permanent fund and fund something, we're all going to be in trouble because everybody's going to get their fingers into it and away we go. So again, we have some other very difficult situations to deal with it there. It has not had a public hearing to the extent that they have had public hearings, teleconferences, etc. They haven't had that. We had some as far as residency are concerned. And some of it was brought out through old timers and that type of situation, but not on this particular bill. For the same reasons that I decided, or that we decided not to hear or not to have the longevity bonus program in the residency bill, I still maintain this for the same reasons. Because they can have, and they will have, I've already established it with finance, it still involves around that this finance will have teleconference hearings and give it the hearing that it so richly deserves. I've already cleared that with the finance chairman. I also sit on finance, so I can assure you that will be done. I've already made those arrangements. I thought I'd just tell you that in the beginning. Mr. Schultz, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, When you were referring to the bill that we passed out of the committee, I just would like to have the people here in the audience know that there's a few of us here that believe that we shouldn't change any of our residency requirements and that we should only change residency requirements as required by on a case-by-case basis as they go to court and change them. But I myself, personally, I feel that we should impose residency requirements as long as we're here, and we should not change them only on a case-by-case basis in everything.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Mr. Cobb.
Yes, through the chair to the sponsor's representative. Do any other states, in your knowledge, have longevity bonus programs?
I have not researched the background of the program as such, however, from some of the material that I did learn while the Senate was working on this bill, yes, there are similar programs in other states. It seems to me that the state of Colorado has one such, but I don't know any of the details of it.
But do other states, they have retirement programs for their elderly that's not necessarily longevity?
Those perhaps are participatory programs, I suspect they are that.
I would like to depart from the normal activity of the committee, because I see we do have an answer, and I would extend an invitation to answer that question, Paula, from Senator Ray's office, or Mr. Tillinghast, to give us that information, if you will, now.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, for the record, John Tillinghast, attorney for the Senate Residency Committee. The state of Colorado had a longevity bonus program where you had to be there 35 years, and it was struck down by the Colorado Supreme Court in the case of Jeffries versus State in 1979.
Mr. Tillinghast, what was the residency limitation?
It was 35 years.
What was it when it was struck down, or what did it become when it became?
30 days.
30 days. Thank you. Mr. Cobb.
The program no longer exists now, is that right?
I believe it now exists as just a basically an equal retirement benefits program.
Is it the benefits the same as it was prior?
I don't know, Paula. Do you know if the benefits
are the same? It's turned into a base needs program with just a 30-day residency.
A base needs program.
But it was a retirement program for 35 years residency.
Thank you very much, Mr. Miller.
Sure, I just want to mention that I guess we all had different reasons for not including this in the last bill. Your reason was because we were currently in court. My reason was because I knew this bill was coming over for the Senate. So that's why I didn't include it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Different strokes for different folks, I guess. Is that what he's saying? Thank you, Mr. Miller. Are there any further questions from the witness? Mr. Munson, thank you very much for your
thank
testimony. Rose, would you care to come up, please?
For the record, I'm Rose Palmquist. I'm a senior advocate. I'm also representing in this testimony Older Persons Action Group. I've heard a lot of discussion about the original longevity bonus being a reward or an honor, as you called it, for the hardships that were sustained in the days before statehood, as for instance, not being able to vote for president. It also stated that the bonus in the legislative intent part of the bill, that the bonus was to retain the resources, the state resources of the knowledge and skill of its older people. I'm sorry, I'm developing a little cold. Also, I want you to note my lapel, too.
Symbol of poverty, is
yes,
that what that
is? Yes, right. Upcoming poverty.
Thank you very much. Upcoming Okay.
At that time, of course, this was long before we got any Prudhoe oil benefits. It was considered also to be an economic benefit to the state and especially its local communities, even though the bonus was at that time $100 a month. And it started out on January 1973 with 3,641 successful applications. That many payments went out. And it was a terrific benefit to the local communities. For your information, I recall that at that time, Senator Homan was discouraging his elderly from applying for the program. And I think I convinced him after I had been to Homer and heard the testimony of the mayor of Homer of the benefit that their businesses, their local businesses, derived from the $100 checks which went to 111 elderly in that community, which of course meant it was 11,000 that was split up amongst the lonely local businesses. Those Whether we need the economic benefit is not a question that I'm going to raise. I will stress, however, that the that the retention of that expertise and knowledge is extremely important. The we support our college people on the assumption that by giving student loans that we will retain a mental capacity that might otherwise be lost. The president of APU calls the alternative a brain drain. The alternative to the longevity bonus being discontinued would be a drain from the state of the knowledge and skills, expertise of the older older people. The experience from the administration of the longevity bonus program did demonstrate that the percentage of elders in the state increased over the period of time. I noticed that the 1980 census, I think we've had some difficulty with their accounts, but it did show an increase of the percentage of elderly in our population. Any state needs a good demographic mix of ages in its population if you're going to have the right kind of psychology of a stable population. If people are going to earn their retirement here and immediately leave the state and spend it elsewhere, the state has definitely lost not only the financial economic benefit, but it loses a positive psychology. If your folks are here, it's apt that when you retire, you'll stay here and your kids and so on down the line. If you retire, you're all a little younger than I am, and if you retire and immediately go outside, you're going to pass that psychology on to your kids, many of whom, I would assume, were already working. So the state does need to encourage the improvement of the percentage of elderly in the state, and the benefits, I think, would be not so demonstrable, but certainly tremendous. I understand from the Longevity Bonus Office that we now have 9,751 recipients of the bonus. And according to the, if we go by the 1980 census, and we have no accurate census since then, inaccurate as you might think that one was, at that time there were 11,000 some hundred people, 65 and older. Then there were 21,000 some hundred people between the ages of 60. And and that was in 1980, so all of the people who were 60 or older, those under 65 would by now be 62 or 63 in fact. And the question of how many of those people are still in the state, of course, is anybody's guess. I have noticed the figures that have been put out by all kinds of different sources. And I believe that some of the figures are greatly inflated. The one figure, which I think may be a little low, is that there would be something over 13,000 that would be immediately eligible for the bonus. We can assume that the present situation is that, yes, the longevity bonus was a good thing for the state. Forget about rewarding the elderly. I claim that the state has been good to us. We don't need any additional awards. If you want to honor us, that's fine and dandy. I think we all should honor our older generation. But I don't think we need the reward. But I think you need us to stay here. And most healthy elderly do make a substantial contribution anyway, whether they get the bonus or not. So the situation is that with the best case, and I have every belief that the time to have gone to court over this was immediately during the Hammond administration. As you know, the Attorney General, that Attorney General threw in the towel. We are now about 8 months into the next administration. And I don't think that the legislature can take a chance on winning 25 years of residency as a requirement for the longevity bonus. And if you're going to ride on that optimism, what will you do if you fail? The or supposing that the case isn't thrown out, but Vest wins, and you have to, without having funded the program, address a judge's decision that Vest and all others like him are eligible. I believe that the legislature needs to solve the problem and not to back off from it. There's no question that the title, longevity bonus, may have to, it will be inappropriate. We cannot take people include them in the program with 1 year's residence and call it a longevity program. But the terminology is not what's important. The thing that is important is how are you going to further what the 71-72 legislature had in mind, which was reversing the population, the trend toward population loss of a segment of the state's resource. OPAG had proposed one way to pull down the cost and to have a calculable benefit to the state, one that would easily be measured, was that those who were at all able-bodied would perform a public service, a voluntary public service, so you wouldn't have employees with compensation and insurance problems to figure out. A voluntary public service work program, which work could be done for any nonprofit organization, for all of these services the citizens provide, and health commissions, road commissions, public service areas, all of those are unpaid people, all of the nonprofits, the hospitals, the schools. The number of public service possibilities is really unlimited. However, that idea did not take hold, and you're looking at how otherwise to handle this problem. The Senate bill proposes funding from the percentage of the earnings of the permanent fund. The state did do it out of its general fund. The state funded it from its general fund when the state was entering into the annual appropriations between $122 and $123 million. My contention is that if you're looking at $3 billion or $2 billion or $1 billion, you're a far cry from $122 million, and that certainly it's only a question of what you want to do. The money is there. I am not taking a position, and OPAG has not taken a position on how you should fund the program. We're going to leave that to the wisdom in your various committees and in your legislature. I think that OPAG, representing older people, and myself individually, say that what is important is how you manage to keep the resource in the state. And whether you do it through the general fund or you decide that the Senate bill may at this time be the best way to go, we're going to leave to you. Of course, we have already testified on the House side in the Hess Committee that no way would we accept a gradual transfer to welfare. No way would we accept that. The thing that I learned when I administered the longevity bonus program is that there were many, very many elderly who were in need of assistance but refused to apply. And they met those needs when they got the longevity bonus program. The state was saving what they would have spent out of one pocket by putting it into the other, called the longevity bonus program. The other thing that the state gained, in addition to keeping the resource and the knowledge and expertise, is that you had a population that was much more secure. And if your mothers and fathers were getting the bonus, or your uncles and aunts, you could see that they felt more secure, and you were more secure in turn. I know that my three kids, two of whom live in the valley and are very good citizens, if I might add, feel better because I am more secure. And I don't have to live with them. Fortunately, I'm living in a smaller community, and I don't have to face those horrible rent and housing shortages that they face in Fairbanks and Anchorage and other places. I suppose an older person couldn't even find a place to rent in Juneau during the legislative session.
A younger person,
yeah. The legislator.
So there's a great benefit to the state and to the state's population by continuing the incentive to those who qualify normally, and then shut the program down until the legislature did make a decision. At that time, I thought that approach and setting up an interim study committee, which would come back to you next year with maybe some additional options that haven't been addressed by Mr. Tillinghast, or an improvement of those options which Mr. Tillinghast presented, might be a way to go, but that isn't the subject you're addressing this afternoon, and so I'll leave it with just that statement. I haven't studied this bill from the standpoint of changes, but I did have a little problem with, probably on page 4, section 8.3. Resident, how long he remains a resident. Now, if that is amplified through regulations by the longevity bonus office, I would be comfortable with that. But I think that if they were to express only what is in the law, I would be worried with not having it tightened up on residency. That concludes my testimony.
Rose, it has been established in the residency bill itself what is residency, and it's already been tightened down.
Is
as far
it tighter
as it
than
can
this
be.
Language here?
No, it isn't any tighter than that. Well, yes, they can have a few other things in there too, but covers it though.
Yeah, but the other thing that I think might be a problem in B is the question of confidentiality.
Where'd you see that, Rose?
That's at the top of page 4 under B. And all I need to say on that is that Older Persons Action Group had some discussion with the Attorney General regarding the use of the longevity bonus list for other public purposes. And I was amazed that the reply that we got was that it was a public purpose if the list was used by a legislative or gubernatorial or other political candidate. But it was not a public purpose for Older Persons Action Group to use it to send them free complimentary copies of the Senior Voice.
Any other questions? Any questions from Rose? Scotty?
In the, is there any duplication in the longevity program, say with Pioneer Home program?
Yes, there is, and I believe, Mr. Cowdery, that I made that mistake, and I admitted that I believe that I acted without sufficient thought, because when I was administering the program, I did establish the policy of paying the bonuses to those which the state essentially supported in the Pioneer Homes. I believe that was a mistake.
Is what is the qualifications or requirements different to qualify for?
Yes, the qualifications under the state present laws is 15 years residency immediately preceding application to the Pioneer Home, and it was 25 years continuously in the state at any time for the longevity bonus program. In other words, if they had 25 or 30 years, went outside for any reason, that they said, oh my gosh, I could get $250 and live better in Alaska and I'd get back with my old friends, yeah, they could come back and be eligible.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr.
Larson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the thoughts that I've had on this, and you picked it around some before, and once again, Rose, I'd like to get yours. There are many different programs by which the state, one way or another, subsidizes individuals, whether it be the student loan, fishing loans, home loans, bonus, pioneer homes, permanent fund dividend programs. What would your attitude be, say that if a person was eligible for the longevity bonus or whatever name we're going to call it, that then would make them ineligible for any or all of the other provisions of the state subsidy program?
Representative Larson, my cold is affecting my hearing. Would you?
Okay, sure. Let me put it this way. If someone is in the Pioneer Home, say for example, do you believe then that they should also be eligible for the longevity bonus? Or if they elect to have the longevity bonus, they should not be eligible for the Pioneer Home, as an example?
I would say, Representative Larson and Mr. Chairman, that being a recipient of the longevity bonus should not bar anyone from being eligible to the Pioneer Home. But contrary-wise, a person is a resident of a Pioneer Home, then that question should be looked at as to whether they should also receive not only that substantial benefit that they receive in the Pioneer Home, but also the longevity bonus. I think how I made the mistake was that I assumed that Pioneer Homes, other than the payment, were like the nursing homes. Well, if you go into a nursing home in this state and you're not eligible under the poverty program for Medicaid, and Medicare is not very accessible to people in Alaska and going into nursing homes, it isn't long before you are at the poverty level because they break you. That's not true when you go into a Pioneer Home. I would suggest that everybody study the original bill which established the Pioneer Home program and read what it says. It doesn't say that everybody should pay a fixed amount. It says the commissioner shall determine, based on each person's resources, what they could contribute toward their total cost. But somewhere or another, we've gotten away from that terminology in the law, in the statute, and we have another type of program.
Any further questions? Rose, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Hope your cold gets better.
Oh, I recover fast. I get better when I see you.
Mr. Gore, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I didn't come to give testimony.
All right, sir.
I'm I've got a gold button on. I'm not sorry I wore it because it means I've been here for 30 years. And I'm a member of the Pioneers of Alaska. I'm also a member of the Pioneer Homes Advisory Board. And I will say a couple of things there about Pioneer Home residents who also receive the bonus, longevity bonus.
Would you please state your... I'll allow you to testify from right there if you wish. Give your name and affiliation for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Bob Gore, Robert Gore. I'm from Ketchikan.
Thank you.
I'm here with Grand President of the Pioneers, Dick Meisner, and Louis Odstater, who is also on the Pioneer Home Advisory Board, and the incoming President of Pioneers, Grand President. As far as Pioneer Home recipients of the longevity bonus are concerned, in many instances, in most instances, the longevity bonus pays their monthly home fee. And I also believe that the legislation concerning the homes gives the commissioner the discretion to set the monthly fees charged for both levels of care provided for the home, not on the basis of the resident's ability to pay, but just on the commissioner's discretion. Are you that understanding, too? Okay, I just don't think it says he has to judge the person's ability at all. We know that there are people in the homes who could afford to live someplace else. There are two ways to get into the home. You can pay your way if you're not destitute. You can come under there are two provisions. One is for the destitute, the other is for the people who wish to retire up here and come in on a paying basis. One thing that I have a problem with as far as people in the homes receiving the longevity bonus is concerned is that we have come across instances where a person who is a recipient of the bonus has been under the wing of his family to the point where he's been influenced by his family to give them the longevity bonus check, and it goes to the building up of the estate that his kids get, that the state doesn't share in, because the Attorney General's office seems to be very reluctant to come against an estate, to file a lien against an estate of a deceased Pioneer Home resident for the cost of his care while he was in the home. We've had some instances there that have come to our attention. One of them was a former legislator who had his father in the home and kept his father's Social Security and his longevity bonus checks. And when his father died in the home up in Fairbanks, he had a sizable charge incurred. It was a recommendation of the Pioneer Home Advisory Board that the state proceed against the estate. Nothing was done. I guess the Attorney General's office at that time said, well, we haven't been doing that. It's something that could be corrected. I don't think it's any great deal that should come up right here. However, as far as the Pioneers are concerned in a position, as far as longevity bonus is concerned, we want to see the bonus preserved. We feel this way about it, that we have, in the state of Alaska now, created a class of old-timers who are dependent on the longevity bonus for subsistence. This isn't something fancy. It might give them a little extra cream in the coffee or something like that, or put some chocolate syrup on his ice cream once in a while, but mainly it goes for necessities, and their necessities are on a subsistence level. And I also would like to say right now that I know a number of these people who are recipients, and believe me, gentlemen, they're in a traumatic state right now, wondering what the future holds for them and how the legislature is going to treat them. The old-timers some of them have a real tenuous hold on stability and life. And when they start to worry about things, it affects them physically and mentally. And you've got problems been created there, and as far as the Pioneers of Alaska are concerned, we are dedicated to doing what we can to preserve that program for them and preserve their way of living, if we can. We know that the present plan is not constitutional. That 25-year eligibility requirement wouldn't hold water. We more or less feel that if it went to court, we stand a good chance to lose the entire program. And have the courts come up and say, well, you got to use the 30-day residency requirement. And we couldn't afford that. The state couldn't afford to fund a 30-day residency requirement plan. We hope somebody comes up with something that's constitutionally viable that we can live with. Maybe what we have in front of us is a 215 is what we're looking for. Maybe Representative Hayes and the administration are going to come up with another alternate. We were in a meeting with the governor's office this morning and advised them that the pioneers are willing to sit down with anybody in the legislature or in the administration and discuss means of providing a continuance of the present benefit of the longevity bonus plan for the present recipients. We did receive the advice, however, that the present recipients can't be grandfathered if this best case were brought to court, and it took 2 years to settle to find out where we're going, that we couldn't grandfather the present recipients. It's apparently not legal, and also we have another problem in that Mr. Vest's attorney has apparently advised some of the people in the Senate that he would file a restraining order or an injunction or ask for a directed verdict in his favor because of the fact that the legislature had more or less indicated they would look over his case and try and come up with some kind of a solution to his problem. That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you, Mr. Gore. Is there anyone else to testify? Mr. DeMann?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Michael DeMann, and I'm here without my mother's knowledge, but I'm testifying on her behalf. During the course of the debate on the longevity bonus, both in the Senate and at this committee meeting, I heard a couple of references to what's called a cutoff, a kind of a waiting period where we would wait to see the outcome of the Vest suit and payments would go forward under one form or the other. I'm not sure if my mother helped to build the state in 1933 when she worked in a cannery for $8 a week, or as she's continued in the state for some 50 years since then. But I do know that under some of the plans that have been proposed, the cutoff date would exclude her, would exclude a lifelong Alaskan resident, someone who has, 1,000 relatives in southeastern Alaska, someone who's worked hard all their lifetime, who plans to stay here, and I'm not sure of her financial circumstances, but I think probably the cream in the coffee and the chocolate on the ice cream, or perhaps a little bit more bowling from my mother, might be the kind of thing that she'd use her money for. I would prefer that any plan that goes forward not leave a loophole where we come back in a year or so and say, well, we had to skip a few people who turned 65 in the meantime, but that's only a small percentage of the population, and meanwhile we've got the whole solution worked out. And I hear references to this, well, it may be too bad that one or two have to slip through, and I just think it would be a darn shame if people who have been here for this length of time and who are now about to enter the time period that you've decided is eligible for the longevity bonus are somehow left out at the time that they are eligible.
Questions for Mr. Mann? Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Mr. Tillinghast?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to take more of the committee's time because y'all gave me more than a fair hearing last time around, but I'm...
You make the record, please.
My name's John Tillinghast, counsel for the Senate Ad Hoc Residency Committee. Let me just briefly try and dissuade the committee from any thought that the existing law is defensible. I say that not as an advocate for a particular bill, but as an attorney who has done a lot of work in this area and who frequently talks with other attorneys in this area, in the Department of Law and out. I'm not going to speak formally for the Department of Law because there's a Department of Law attorney here, but I think their view is the same as mine, that there is no chance whatsoever of saving this law. I could quote, like to quote from a June 29, 1972 bill review letter on the original bill from a deputy attorney general by the name of Gorsuch that says the classification predicated on being here on January 3, 1959 bears little if any rational relationship to any legitimate legislative purpose which this bill is conceivably designed to serve, and this is in all probability unconstitutional. I think Norm hitched his bets a little bit because in 72 some people were hoping that the courts may usher in a new era of law that was more charitable to states on residency requirements. We know after Zobel that precisely the opposite is the case. I agree with Representative Schultz that in almost every instance you ought to fight tooth and nail for a residency requirement and give in only when the final court tells you you have to give in. The problem is that you've got a quirk in this bill, something that's unique to the longevity bonus program, and that's the non-severability clause, which says very clearly that the moment you lose the residency requirement, you have to stop the program. Now, fighting the Vest case not only would have that consequence, and it's a consequence that would come very soon, because as soon as this legislature adjourns without passing constitutional legislation, Mr. Vest's attorney are going to move for summary judgment. It's a procedure that's going to take 45 days to 2 months. They're going to get a judgment from Judge Carpinetti that says the law is unconstitutional. Judge Carpinetti is going to have no discretion but to stop the program because of the non-severability clause. In addition, Judge Carpinetti is probably going to find that the state defended this lawsuit in bad faith because we do not have a good faith defense for this lawsuit. That has two consequences. Consequence number one is that Mr. Vest's attorneys are probably going to get full attorney's fees. If they get full attorney's fees based upon what's called the common fund theory, a percentage of the money that they got for the class they represent, we're talking about paying $15, $20 million potentially in attorney's fees just to Mr. Vest's attorneys. Second, because as early as 1972 the Department of Law believed this law was unconstitutional, it is not inconceivable that a very angry court, and I can guarantee you that Judge Carpinetti will have contempt in mind when we go back to forum, could order retroactive payments for 10 years back to 1972 to everybody who was a year resident during that period of time. There are things that the attorneys could do to stop those consequences from happening. But in all honesty, they are very real consequences, and they're something that the committee has to seriously consider before deciding that this is the place that we're going to fight the residency battle rather than a law that's not going to have these consequences if you lose. Two other points briefly made by Representative Hayes' representative. One, that this is the first incursion on the permanent fund. Again, the Senate believes that if Alaskans' retirement security is in part a function of the proper management of the permanent fund, most Alaskans are going to be even more protective of the proper management of the permanent fund and less inclined to let it be raided. A good example is if the senior citizen representatives here know that their longevity bonus is a function of the proper management of the permanent fund and raiding bills start coming in next session, these people in particular are going to be back here fighting tooth and nail to prevent those raids from happening. It's true that there is one group that's treated unequally by this approach, and that's the folks that are here now but are going to leave at the age of 65. That came up in the Senate Finance Committee. My response then is the same as my response now, which is I really don't think we ought to be making public policy decisions in deference to short-timers who are going to be here for a couple of years and not be here in retirement. If that means they're treated unequally because they want to go to Coral Gables, Florida, that's a voluntary choice they made. I don't think we ought to prejudice Alaska's existing and future elderly because that subclass of people may be hurt by this bill. That's basically the areas that I wanted to cover with respect to Representative Hayes' person's presentation. Other than to say, on the question of intent, you know, if you read the statement of intent on the 1972 law, it says that it's very difficult financially to retire in Alaska, and that Social Security isn't enough to keep people here, and that people with ties here are being forced to leave because they can't afford to stay, and that was, I think as Rose Palmquist said much better than I could, the main purpose for the longevity bonus law. That's a permanent problem. It's as bad today as it was in 1972, and it's going to stay that way for quite a while. So, and this bill is as responsive to that problem as was the original legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Tillinghast.
Thank you,
Any
Mr.
questions?
Chairman.
Mr. Miller?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make a statement and ask Mr. Tillinghast if I have the whole of it. It seems to me we only really have three choices in this matter. We can do nothing, and then Mr. Vest will bring his case, and as you know, as sure as we're all sitting here, we'll lose. In which case, because of the non-severability clause, the judge can't just say, for the time being, 1 year is going to be enough. He's got to say the whole act is unconstitutional. So everybody that's receiving the longevity bonus right now will not receive it, because there just won't be any alternative. That non-severability clause probably was a mistake when we put it in there. But then I was one of the people that put it in there. Red Swanson sitting back there, too. He and I in this room voted on that bill. But in any case, it's in there. So that's one option. We can do nothing, and if we lose, which we will, everybody's out. Or we can pass this bill, and the money will be funded out of the permanent fund earnings, or we can take it out of the general fund. But it seems to me that's our only three choices. So my suggestion, Mr. Speaker, is that being the case, I think the best forum to decide, I don't think any of us want choice number one. I don't think anybody of us want to roll the dice in a loaded game and see the program go down the tube. So if there are only two choices then, are either to fund it out of the permanent fund or out of the general fund, I suspect the thing for us to do is to end up to finance, and they're going to have to look closer, strictly from the money standpoint. And then we'll all probably, on the basis then of whatever they decide, I'm sure we'll end up deciding the matter on the floor of the House, because some people will want to go one route, some people want to go another route. It would be a matter of whether to adopt this route or just go directly to the general fund, which, but that's a decision we have to make. I think, Mr. Speaker, we ought to move this bill right away up to finance, because time is a waste. And if that gavel comes down in the session and we haven't dealt with this matter, Mr. Vesper is not going to wait until the second session of the 13th state legislature. He's going to file. He's just going to move immediately. And I don't blame him. He'd be derelict in his duties if he did not.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Cobby.
Yes. It seems the original program, in my opinion, was it was the intent. It was kind of a limited program to start with to address the needs or to benefit the pioneers or whoever. But it seems to me this deviates from that some intent. It seems now it's a retirement program for those residents over 65 years old. I think it's two different things. And I think the original program would eventually phased out, would be a phased out program, where this seems to be a continuing program. And I would like to have your comments on an amendment on page 2, line 6. After the word over, add the following words, on or before the date of this act becomes law.
Two prop up. Was that the question?
Yes.
Would you read it in context, please?
Yes. Section, or persons who may. A person who is 65 years of age or over on the date before, on or before the date this act becomes law.
Well, if this law becomes effective on July 1, then it'd be June 30th, 1918 is the magic date. If you turn 65 by 11:59 p.m., June 30th, 1918, you're fine.
Mr. Cotter, I'll clarify what you said.
A person who is 65 years of age on, of age, or over, on or before the date this act becomes law.
Right.
When would this act become law?
Well, let's just say July 1.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, that would mean that you would have a birthday date, and if you made it, you were in. If you didn't make it, you were out. That's a pretty serious policy call for folks who are 63 now, have lived in Alaska all their lives, mm-hmm. and are going to suffer the same problems when they turn 65 as the current ones. That's a policy question that I'm just going to have to leave with you all.
That's why I said earlier that perhaps another bill to address the older people's retirement of our state in the future. But however, it seems to me with this amendment, we could take care of the people that's in the past.
But I'd file suit.
Mr. Vesper, brother,
you can file a bill.
Mr. Vesper, 64-year-old brother.
The other problem is that then you have made it special interest legislation, which denigrates the argument for using the permanent fund. I know my dividend's going down by 25%, but I also know that I'm going to have a little more wherewithal when I turn 65 to be able to stay here and not have to go down to Sun City. But I would not have that assurance if that amendment were in the bill. And I would probably justifiably scream bloody murder that my dividend was going to be reduced.
Thank you, Mr. Tillyon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It's the intent of the chair to pass this to committee, or out of the committee. I just thought I would give you what the chair's intent is. So that we're going to, the finance committee can have a full hearing with the teleconferences, et cetera, because nothing has been done on it yet. And I'd like to see that happen. That is the intent of the chair. Is there any, is there someone else, please?
My name is Deborah Vogt, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the state, and I'm the attorney who is presently handling the Vest suit. I just had a couple of points that I would like to address one general, and that is if there's any remaining doubt as to what the Department of Law thinks about the defensibility of the existing bill. Mr. Tillinghast has stated it correctly. While some individual attorneys within the office might feel that they could go into court and make an argument and therefore it's defensible, nobody thinks we can win. And so long as there's no doubt about that, I'll address the bill that's presently before you. The problem that
Excuse me, please. I just have a question to ask. Is there any way whatsoever, indirectly or directly, that by you testifying before this committee would have any reflection on the court case if you represent the plaintiff?
I don't think so, Mr. Chairman. I think that the state's position on the legality of the present legislation is already before the court. I think that...
Can our decisions influence, have any attempt or appearance or perception of influencing the court's decision when and if it does come up? If so, I would be rather hesitant on accepting your testimony to the committee, just from a legal standpoint.
I understand your concern, Mr. Chairman. I think that in this particular case, given the history of the lawsuit up to this point, and if I may say so, the obviousness of the question, that I'm not prejudicing the state's position in the lawsuit by my testimony today. I think that last summer we were concerned with what we can do about this program to preserve the, to maintain payments to the people who are presently dependent on them. I don't think that our legal position is any secret or ever has been.
It would not compromise us in any way, or you, by your testimony. You would feel comfortable with that?
I do, sir.
Fine. Thank you. Continue.
Yes. The bill that's presently before you has changed since it was originally submitted in that the provision making payments to the best class retroactive to July 1st, 1982 has been deleted. And I think the committee is probably aware that in the settlement last summer that allowed the program to continue until the legislature could convene, we did make the agreement that the best efforts of the Legislative Council would be used to pass legislation, and that that legislation would be retroactive to July 1st, 1982. Mr. Vest's attorney, essentially in return for that agreement, agreed not to pursue retroactive benefits earlier than July 1st, 1982. If this bill is passed in its present form, the lawsuit isn't settled because that retroactive payment isn't made. We will be in court. We will not be in court on as serious a question as we would be if this legislation were not passed at all. But we will still be in court. The lawsuit will not be settled, and we'll have to address the question of retroactive payments. Because Vest's attorney gave up last summer his his right to pursue retroactive payments all the way back to 1971, if the legislation is passed and does not settle the suit, he's under no obligation to stick by that agreement, and he can pursue retroactive payments, as Mr. Tillinghast outlined, all the way back to 1971. The question of whether he would be successful all the way back is an open question. I think that part of the answer to it does lie, or his argument certainly would contain elements that the attorney in charge of reviewing the bill when it was first passed, Mr. Gorsuch, did have reservations about the constitutionality at the time that it was passed. He can make a fairly strong argument that payments should be made back beyond July 1st. There's also the question of attorney's fees, which, in my opinion, would be more easily dealt with should legislation be passed that dispenses with the entire suit than if we have to go back into court and argue about any aspect of it. I think the committee should be aware that, in a sense, this bill would institute an expensive program and would not settle a lawsuit. It seems, from my perspective as the attorney handling the suit, if the legislature is going to do something, it had ought to go the whole distance and take care of the lawsuit.
Is there any questions, Mr. Miller?
Sure. You're suggesting we make it retroactive to what date?
July 1st, 1982 is the date.
1982.
Approximately the date that the suit was filed.
Could you tell me, please, you know what the thinking was in the Senate for removing that language?
I don't know. I haven't followed it.
Maybe we could just, Mr. Chairman, informally ask John if he knows what the rationale was.
John.
Well, I was asked by the Senate Finance Committee whether that committee or individual legislators in the committee were we're bound by a court order to appropriate $11.4 million, which is what we're talking
about. For the
rest
of the afternoon, there will be a test of
retroactive award. Told them they weren't. They knew there were risks that if you didn't put the retroactive money in, you would narrow the lawsuit to the question of retroactivity. And the result could run from getting away scot-free to not having to pay any retroactive awards. The theory that we had solved the problem prospectively and that was good enough, and retroactive awards are in the discretion of the court. Two in a worst case, probably going back 10 years. And the Senate Finance Committee simply decided to take that calculated risk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Lard, I'm sorry, Mr. Baskin.
Thank you. What about the question of payment of the attorney's fees?
We had just...
Did the Senate deal with that? I mean, she sort of mentioned it in passing.
Oh, my testimony regards what the court might do with attorney's fees. My opinion is that the court would be more inclined to grant greater attorney's fees if we have to go back into court, and whether Senate Finance dealt with the question of attorney's fees or not.
Would that be the conclusion of your testimony this
morning?
Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I'm sorry, but would you kindly repeat your name for the record so that we do get it? I didn't.
Yes, my name is Deborah Vogt, V-O-G-T.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. Is there any further people to testify on this bill? Is there any, I guess everyone understands why I'm going to pass it through committee with individual recommendations to go to finance. There's no question on that from the committee. Mr. Miller?
Mr. Chairman, I'm persuaded that we should go the retroactive route and resolve the
amendment. Would you have an amendment to this?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't have the language, I don't have a mandatory language, but I think conceptually I will just move that we make the act, and you can work with counsel for the exact language, that we make the act retroactive to...
Mr. Chairman?
January 1982, maybe Mr.
Baskin.
I think that you add a new section, making it retroactive is probably the way to do it.
If this act becomes effective?
Well, it's retroactive to July 1, 1982.
Mr. Chairman, I just make move that we make it retroactive. Our legal beagles can work out.
Would this then affect page 5, line 23? Does that take effect January 183, or is it someplace else?
No.
You want to make it retroactive? Mr.
Chairman, the effective date would have to remain the same so that this particular piece of act becomes effective as of July 1. However, its effect will be retroactive to July 1 of last year.
Mr. Chairman, we would simply have to adopt whatever it was the Senate pulled out.
That's what I was going to
say. All right, do you have the language, Mr. Tillinghast?
We don't have a prior version of the bill with us, but the sections that you're making retroactive are the sections defining residency, which are sections section 3 and section 8. So you would create a new section 12 to the bill.
Okay, in order to clarify this, I'm still going to pass this out of committee with that recommendation. Have that amendment. Well, we'll have to back to committee substitute.
Yeah, but I don't think we have to see it, Mr. Chairman. It's very clear what we're doing. We're doing whatever is necessary to make it retroactive to
in with consideration for the sponsor. Paula, could you have that drawn up for us?
Right. I was looking at the original language from the first version of the bill.
Fine. But I wondered if we could take care of this business in front of us. Have that added into the bill as a committee. It'll be a House committee substitute. Senate Bill number 215, right? Rules?
Right.
Dated 517 from that. It's changing that one. Am I correct there? When could the committee expect this to come before it? We don't have to have it come before us again. We will just accept it as such when it does get here.
About 5 minutes.
Yeah.
The committee substitute?
They had the version already on the thing over there. All they have to do is just put in that one thing.
Okay, then I'm going to hold this bill. Well, the first thing I want to do is instruct committee secretary to have the testimony written, taken from the tapes and written for finance from Ms. Vogt, I believe, and Mr. Tillinghast, on that portion of it that we changed. So I'm going to hold this bill until it, you say get it back over here before 3 o'clock. Could that be done conveniently?
Could it be done so, Mr. Chair? We're going to do it right now.
Fine, sir. We will just hold this in abeyance then until we get that and then we can pass this bill. I think then that
The committee will stand at ease for a moment for those people that don't wish to hear. My sponsor is here. Am I right, Ed?
Yes.
It's the Senate State Affairs. An act relating to the Alaska Council on Science and Technology and providing for an effective date. Senator Fisher, please. Thank you for taking the time to come down.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Vic Fisher, Senator from Anchorage. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to just say a few words. I feel I don't have to say too many. Some months ago, we held joint hearings on the Alaska Council on Science and Technology. At that time, we reviewed the audit report, which had a lot of negative comments. We heard testimony from the scientific community, from the administration, generally favoring changes in the mission of the council, elimination of the grant-making authority, repeal of the Northern Technology Program, and various other proposals, which are outlined in a memo, which I believe is in your files, dated May 16, from me to other senators, which is when they, for purpose of bill action on the floor of the Senate. Legislation has been endorsed by the administration. The money for the council is in the budget, in the governor's budget, in the Senate budget. I have not checked the House budget on it. And I commend the bill to your favorable attention.
Senator Fisher, how much is the appropriation for the council?
Mr. Chairman, the appropriation is $100,000. The purpose of that money is not for staff, it is for travel of the council and for purposes of convening special panels as may be necessary. I would just advise this afternoon in context of a totally different discussion that the governor has recently asked the council to look into a couple of specific issues, I think dealing with transportation, dealing with something else, but essentially trying to use the Alaska scientific community, technological community to help the state deal with some specific problems. And the $100,000 would be used to fund these special panels that would be convened to provide assistance to the state.
Senator, do we have a same type of, not exactly a council, but a group of people in the University of Alaska that do the very same thing? In other words, I guess what I'm trying to say is, I'm trying to hear from you why it is important that we maintain the council, per se.
The purpose of the council is to really pull out, bring in people from the University of Alaska. The university is organized in all sorts of different ways. The various units have their own missions within the university for special research, for teaching, and so on. The council can provide a link to the university to pull out specific individuals who have special capabilities. Furthermore, the council also can work with the specialists in the private sector, with the oil companies, with engineering firms, and so on, which they've done so far very successfully, to provide specific assistance to the state. Another very special function, which is evolving right now, is in support of Senator Murkowski's bill to establish the Arctic Research Council, which is finding its way through the United States Congress right now. And Senator Murkowski has advised us that the Alaska Science and Council on Science and Technology would provide the best and most effective link with the federal council that would be established under his legislation. And in fact, again, I would just advise that the governor's office is using the council to provide backup for Senator Murkowski's efforts in behalf of this Arctic Council.
This would not be a duplication of yours.
This would in no way at all.
Thank you, Senator.
Especially, Mr. Chairman, especially since we're eliminating staff. This will be handled by existing staff within the governor's office.
What happened to the people that are on, that were on staff prior to this thing?
I assume they'll be out looking for work unless they've already found it.
I see. Any other questions from the committee? Mr. Larson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, one question I have, and I must say that I am in agreement with what you're trying to do and how it's to be accomplished. I have one little question with, and that's the makeup of the council itself.
with one member representing the office of the governor and eight members selected from the recommendations of the state scientific community, basically. I think one basic group that's not